Great. Thanks very much, G. I'd like to start off by thanking everyone for the invitation. So I will be talking today about some recent work with a few collaborators. So two students, Stefano Antonini and Peter Simigia, as well as our senior collaborators, Brian Swingle and Mark Van Ramsdonk. I think I've been informed that today the talk is going to have a relatively broad audience. So I'll try to pitch it at what I think is hopefully a pretty accessible level, but please don't hesitate to stop me if something is unclear. And I guess what I do hope everyone can take away from the talk is that basically the kind of slogan or the goal here is that it seems as though, at least from investigations at the level of effective field theory, if we try to describe certain cosmologies or to realize realistic cosmologies, at least at the level of some homogeneous isotropic gravitational background, it seems like there's not necessarily any obstacle to doing this within a relatively traditional kind of holographic framework. So that's kind of going to be the main message of my talk today. I should first explain something in the title, which is this lambda less than zero. So lambda here is the cosmological constant for the theories that we're going to consider. So it's just some constant term in the covariant gravitational action. And so right off the bat, there's kind of something suspicious, which is that we're talking about cosmology, but we're also talking about lambda less than zero. And I think it's pretty frequently stated that we live in a universe which has positive cosmological constant. So this might seem a little bit confusing. So I'll start off giving an important clarification about this point. So what we do know is we have some types of cosmological observations, including very direct probes of the recent expansion history of the universe, like observations of type 1a supernova. And if we combine these with some choice of model, like a particularly simple phenomenological model, like the lambda CDM model, where the recent expansion is described or is sourced by some cosmological constant and then some pressureless dark matter and some regular baryonic matter. It turns out if we combine these astrophysical observations with this choice of a simple model, we do indeed find that the result is a positive cosmological constant. Sort of fitting this model to our data, we end up with the pretty conventional picture of cosmology, where we have the current energy density accounting of the universe corresponds to something like 70% dark energy coming from some cosmological constant, and then 30% from matter, which breaks down into like 25% in the dark sector and then 5% baryonic matter. In particular, these direct geometrical or these direct probes of the geometry of the universe in the relatively recent past, they tell us that the universe is currently undergoing a period of accelerated expansion, which started something like 5 billion years ago. So here on the right, I have some plot of a function I've denoted A of t, which is called the scale factor. And this describes how the universe is expanding as a function of time. In particular, it describes the sort of proper distance between some class of co-moving observers in the universe. You can think of it as the proper distance between some galaxies as the universe is expanding. And this vertical line here is the present time. So we see that, at the present time, the scale factor has a second derivative, which is positive. The scale factor is concave up, and so we're undergoing a period of accelerated expansion. And presumably, if lambda CDM is correct, then this expansion will continue into the future. I'm spending a little while pointing out this fact about acceleration because this is sort of what tells us immediately that in the lambda CDM model, we have to have a positive cosmological constant. If we had zero cosmological constant or we had matter domination, then the scale factor would go as some fractional power of t, which would correspond to a decelerating universe. And if we added some negative cosmological constant on top of that, that would just cause the universe to further decelerate. So the observation that we're currently in a period of accelerated expansion immediately leads in the context of this model to the conclusion that we have a positive cosmological constant. On the other hand, if if we want to try to be as model independent as possible and just look at the observations that I was mentioning before, in this case, what we really have is some sort of direct constraints on the geometry in the relatively recent past. So this includes some constraint that the universe is currently expanding, that this expansion is accelerating. And then we have some other mild constraints on the evolution of the scale factor within a certain range of time. And so in this sort of like more model independent spirit, we can think about trying to understand the most general source of the observed acceleration or the observed behavior of the scale factor that we see. And so in particular, the most general possibility that's consistent with the symmetry of the cosmological background that we might want to preserve, which is the homogeneity and isotropy of sort of the spatial slices in the universe. We might expect that the most general thing that we could write down would be some time-dependent dark energy, which is sourcing this expansion. It's often pretty useful to model this kind of a time-dependent dark energy as arising from the evolution of some scalar field, which is evolving in some sort of potential. So this is called a quintessence model if the dark energy corresponds to some scalar field. And in the context of this model, the fact that the universe is currently accelerating, that just implies that the current value of the potential needs to be positive. So that in particular, the current value of the potential being positive is a necessary condition to ensure acceleration. But the fundamental cosmological constant of the theory, which we can think of as being like the minimum of this potential, we can absorb the cosmological constant into the scalar potential. There's no reason that this couldn't be positive, negative, or zero in this kind of model. You know, any of those possibilities would be allowed with the sort of like most naive observational input that I was just describing. Okay, so given that we've kind of identified two possibilities, an important question to try to understand is if there are any hints as to whether we should prefer one over the other, or we should concentrate our theoretical efforts on one case or the other. So on the cosmological constant model or time-dependent dark energy. So the first thing we can ask is if we get any hints from looking at observations. So in particular, we might want to ask if applying the sort of simplest phenomenological model, the lambda CDM model that I was talking about before, comparing that to some data, if we run into any problems. And so it turns out that lambda CDM is a very excellent model. It's helped us understand a lot about the sort of late time expansion of the universe it is still for most data sets, it provides a very good fit. An issue arises when one tries to use lambda CDM to interpolate between two different data sets. So some, say, relatively early time data set, like the cosmic microwave background, which observations of the cosmic microwave background are probing, the expansion history all the way back to recombination. So if we try to use lambda CDM to interpolate between a relatively sort of an observation of relatively early times like the CMB and observations at relatively late times like the type 1a supernova that I was just talking about, then this typically leads to problems. In particular, if we fit the parameters of the model with one data set and then the parameters of the model with another data set, the result is that some of those parameters turn out to seemingly be inconsistent. The most infamous example of this is the so-called Hubble tension, which is some discrepancy between the local value of the sort of Hubble parameter that tells us about the current expansion of the universe. Discrepancies between the observations or discrepancies between the value you get from fitting early time data and late time data is seemingly well above the five sigma level at this point. So here, to emphasize this point, I've plotted in blue are the supernova observations from the Pantheon Plus collaboration, and in red is the theory curve for lambda CDM, where we're using parameters that are coming from fitting the CMB data from Planck 2018. The x-axis here is like the scale factor for the supernova when the supernova released the light that we're seeing currently. And then on the y-axis is some measure of distance, which is related to the ratio of the source luminosity and the apparent luminosity of the supernova. So the point of this plot is just to illustrate that sort of the most naive lambda CDM model without additional ingredients seemingly gives like a pretty bad fit to at least one of these data sets. There have been various proposals for how to try to ameliorate the situation. Some of those involve time-dependent dark energy, although it's probably worth me clarifying that not any time-dependent dark energy scenario is necessarily going to help resolve this tension. And in fact, some of the sort of most basic extensions of the lambda CDM model with time-dependent dark energy would make this Hubble tension worse. So one has to be careful when thinking about what kinds of models with time-dependent dark energy would help to resolve this problem with lambda CDM. On the other hand, so we talked about observations, we can also ask whether theory has some preference between this possibility of a cosmological constant or some time-dependent dark energy. So it's a little bit difficult to answer this question without really having a very detailed understanding of non-perturbative quantum gravity, but we can at least see a few hints, I think. So first of all, in string theory, often one is interested in trying to build four-dimensional, effective field theories that could, say, realize the physics of our universe through compactifications in string theory. And these certainly, result in various scalar fields, which, perhaps in certain models could provide some candidates for something like a time-dependent dark energy. Maybe more to the point is that in terms of realizing the possibility of a positive cosmological constant in string theory, this is famously a little bit of a controversial subject. So there's a huge amount of literature sort of following these authors, KKLT, proposing various constructions of possible metastable de Sitter vacua in string theory. But I think it's fair to say at this point that we don't have any, really completely controlled microscopic example where we really understand all of the physics we would like to in detail. This has, I think, led some authors to conjecture there's a possibility that metastable de Sitter vacua do not actually exist within string theory. On the other hand, from ADS-CFT, we sort of have this very, very precise non-perturbative formulation of quantum gravity in backgrounds that have negative cosmological constant. So at the very least, we understand the situation of quantum gravity in those kinds of backgrounds a lot better at this stage. As far as having time-dependent scalar fields arising in the context of ADS-CFT, one can sort of argue by analogy with holographic RG flows that it seems plausible, at least, that if we did have some sort of a UV completion of some effective gravitational theory in the vein of ADS-CFT, that having some scalar fields that vary on cosmological timescales might be generic within that space of possible UV completions. So I'm sort of channeling here a recent paper by Mark. Maybe it's worth also sort of like briefly pointing out that the possibility of having some time-dependent scalar field driving some period of accelerated expansion is already relatively widely accepted within the community that studies cosmology. In particular, people often use a model of this type to study inflation. Great. So, given all of these priors, I hope that I've at least convinced some people that thinking about the situation of cosmology with lambda less than zero is at least plausible and interesting to think about studying. A natural question to try to ask is whether or not we can sort of start playing around and cook up some lambda less than zero gravitational effective theories that we expect should have some sort of a holographic description and that can give rise to something like realistic cosmologies, at least at the level of the background spacetimes. And so I'll try to argue in this talk that the answer to this is yes. So let me first start off by talking about some of the inputs that we might expect should come from holography when we're trying to understand what the right space of gravitational effective field theories with lambda less than zero is to consider. Great, so as I've motivated here, we want to think about lambda less than zero cosmologies that should have some holographic description. And the question we first want to start off with is whether or not the existence of this holographic description is going to put any conditions on the space of effective theories or their solutions that we should sort of impose from the beginning. Something that's worth pointing out is that just having negative lambda is not sufficient to ensure that there's something like a conventional holographic description. So as a sort of simple example, we can think about the case of a theory where we have just some negative cosmological constant, as well as some radiation, so some perfect fluid radiation component in the energy momentum content of the universe. And we want to think about some homogeneous and isotropic cosmological solutions that are spatially flat. So the spatial sections are just regular R3. So the equation of motion that describes the expansion of this kind of a space-time is given here. This is the relevant version of the Friedmann equation. So h here is the Hubble parameter. It's just related to the time derivative of the scale factor. And so the expansion here is being sourced by some radiation density as well as some cosmological constant. Finding the solution in this case, we see that essentially the result is some universe that begins with some Big Bang, undergoes some long period of radiation dominated expansion. Eventually the sort of positive contribution to the Friedmann equation from the radiation is exactly compensated by the negative contribution from our negative cosmological constant. The Hubble expansion sort of slows and is instantaneously zero. We have some recollapse and then the universe starts to shrink again and eventually ends up with some big crunch. So this is some time symmetric cosmology that starts with a Big Bang and ends with a big crunch. But an immediate problem for trying to understand a description of this in the context of ADS-CFT is that the space-time doesn't have any ADS boundaries. So usually in ADS-CFT, the UV completion of some gravitational theory is some CFT that lives at some asymptotically ADS boundary of the space-time. And this is sort of like a crucial ingredient for applying, standard holographic dictionary to understand the how the bulk physics is being encoded in the CFT. So in this kind of a situation, it's a little bit mysterious where the CFT would live if there was some sort of holographic description. So a way around this issue and a way around a lot of issues in theoretical physics, I guess, is to think about performing an analytic continuation. So here I'll just be talking about, an analytic continuation at the level of our background solution here. So in particular, we're going to perform some Wick rotation of this time coordinate. T goes to some I tau. So at the level of the equations of motion, this has the effect of replacing any terms with two time derivatives by some negative of a term with two time derivatives. And a crucial ingredient here is that the background that we are hoping to describe had some time reflection symmetry. So this analytic continuation will result again in some real Euclidean geometry. We don't have to worry about arriving at any complex metrics from performing this procedure. So in our example again, performing the analytic continuation at the level of the equations of motion, this has the effect of, reversing the signs of these two energy components here. And then the resulting solution is, the result is some Euclidean space-time, which we can think of as being like some Euclidean wormhole that has these two asymptotically ADS boundaries. So as we approach the boundary in this direction, the cosmological constant starts to dominate over the radiation term, and the space-time just becomes very close to something that is a vacuum space-time with just a negative cosmological constant, which is anti-de Sitter. So the result of doing this analytic continuation for the cosmological solution is that we end up with this Euclidean ADS wormhole. I should mention that the idea that something like these kinds of ADS Euclidean wormhole solutions, one could perform an analytic continuation, and that correspondingly this could be relevant for describing cosmology in the context of some holographic construction that originated with Maldacena and Maus, as far as I know, I think maybe in 2004. Something that I think puzzled them was how to understand these wormholes in the context of ADS-CFT. They seem to present some sort of factorization puzzle. But in various papers, so starting with this paper and then with various other papers, we suggested some sort of a possible microscopic realization of a holographic theory that would give rise to this sort of ADS wormhole as some vacuum solution. So these theories are like, they involve some three-dimensional conformal field theories that are coupled by some auxiliary four-dimensional CFT system. But the details of this holographic construction are not going to be necessary for any of the arguments that I'll be talking about here. The point is just going to be that starting with the kinds of cosmologies that we were just talking about and performing an analytic continuation, one can arrive at some space-time that has got some ADS boundaries, and that this is maybe a hint towards the fact that we could maybe have a more conventional sort of realization of ADS-CFT for the system. Okay, great. So the proposal then for the rest of my talk is going to be that having a holographic description for these negative lambda cosmologies should require the existence of some time symmetric solution, which we can analytically continue to obtain some asymptotically ADS wormhole. So at the very least, for the sort of more conventional form of ADS-CFT that we would like, this is just going to be assumed to be some necessary set of conditions. It's possible that there, one could envision some other kinds of less standard holographic frameworks that could realize cosmology, but this is going to be our assumption that this is a necessary condition. Great. Okay, so because we want the cosmologies that we're interested in to have some sort of a time-dependent dark energy, we're going to think about a theory where we have essentially pure Einstein gravity, which is coupled to some scalar that has some associated potential. And then we also have some additional, possibly radiation or matter that we add to the theory. So that's the theory that we're going to be thinking about henceforth. And something to point out is that, okay, within the context of this theory, it's not the case that any lambda less than zero potential is necessarily going to permit Euclidean ADS wormholes. So this was sort of the point we were making before. So we should think carefully about what sorts of potentials will allow us to describe these Euclidean ADS wormholes. So to do this, we should first think about what the geometry of these wormholes is like. So if we want to arrive at some spatially flat cosmology, then this corresponds to some R3 symmetry, which is in the Euclidean continuation, it's like some planar symmetry in the transverse directions, transverse to this sort of Euclidean tau coordinate. So the metric then takes this form. It's described by this metric where we have some function A of tau. With this theory and then our particular choice of background, which is this wormhole ansatz, the corresponding scalar field equation looks like this. So we can immediately recognize this is just the equation for some particle moving in some inverted potential minus V. Where we additionally have some sort of a friction type term or possibly an anti-friction term. So if this A prime over A is positive, then we have some damped motion in this potential. Whereas if a prime over a is negative, then we have some anti-damped motion. So in particular, the input here is, or some input here is that we would like this field phi to approach some constant value in the ADS regions in order to make sure that the, you know, in those regions, we basically have something that just looks like an asymptotically ADS spacetime. And without loss of generality, we'll assume that phi is approaching some constant which we set equal to zero. So now we'd like to ask what constraints this puts on the potential that we have, that the motion of this particle in this inverted potential sort of approaches some constant value. So the point is that as we're approaching the ADS region, that A prime over A friction term, that's positive. So we do indeed end up with like some friction as we're, say, approaching the ADS boundary. And so consequently, if we want to end up approaching some constant value of phi, what we would really like is to have phi equals zero be an extremum of the potential. And in particular, it should be a minimum of the inverted potential, so that basically this particle undergoes damp motion until it eventually, you know, either it could oscillate and eventually settle to the value phi equals zero, or it could, you know, slowly approach the value phi equals zero. So we would not like the inverted potential to be at a maximum, since that would then be unstable. So the conditions that this puts on our potential are that we should have phi equals zero be an extremum, so that this first derivative should vanish, and then also the second derivative of the potential should be negative, so that the sort of second derivative of the inverted potential is positive, and the inverted potential is concave up. Great. There's one additional constraint that comes on the second derivative of this potential, which is true in any holographic theory, and this is just the Brentlohner-Friedmann bound, or the BF bound for short. So in four dimensions, this Brentlohner-Friedmann bound takes this form. So the second derivative of the potential is allowed to be negative, but it can't be too negative. And in particular, this ratio of the second derivative and the absolute value of the potential is bounded from below by this negative number. In the context of ADS CFT, this Brentlohner-Friedmann bound is pretty easy to see how it might arise. The second derivative of the potential or the mass term is related through the holographic dictionary to the dimension of some scalar operator in the CFT. And in particular, looking at the corresponding expression for the dimension of the scalar operator, we see in particular if this Brentlohner-Friedmann bound were not satisfied, then seemingly this dimension would be some complex number, which, you know, certainly shouldn't be allowed in any unitary CFT. So in the context of ADS CFT, it's particularly easy to see how this BF bound might arise. Sort of interestingly, in the context of our model, having the potential satisfy the BF bound is exactly equivalent to having the motion close to phi equals zero be that of some overdamped oscillator. So in particular, we expect that if the scalar has approached close enough to phi equals zero, it will, rather than oscillating, it will just eventually start to you know, smoothly approach the position phi equals zero. Great. Okay, so the purpose of that discussion was just to clarify, you know, in the context of these lambda less than zero gravitational effective theories that we might want to use to describe cosmology, what constraints do we have on those theories coming from sort of the most naive requirements of their existing some sort of a holographic description. And so certainly the fact that we have negative lambda, it implies that the V at zero has to be negative. But then in addition, we just argued that the existence of some Euclidean continuation to some real asymptotically ADS wormhole requires that phi equals zero should be an extremum of the potential, and in particular, the second derivative should be negative there. And it also requires that within the context of the theories we're talking about, we're going to be most interested in looking for time symmetric solutions. And then lastly, the requirement of having a stable theory implied that the VF bound also needs to be satisfied for this potential. So the picture you should have in mind throughout this talk is that we have some potential of this form shown here. So on the left is the potential and on the right is the inverted potential. And we can see that this satisfies the requirements that we were just talking about. Phi equals zero is an extreme of the potential. The second derivative is negative. The value is negative. It's maybe not totally clear that it satisfies the BF bound, but in some, you have to choose the second derivative to also satisfy the BF bound. And then we'll be interested in looking for time symmetric solutions. So on the right hand, we're thinking about the evolution in the Euclidean picture or the wormhole picture. So we start from some point, which is labeled by phi zero here. We impose the time symmetric initial conditions that a dot and phi dot vanish at this position, which is the center of our wormhole. And then the Euclidean evolution towards larger or smaller values of tau corresponds to some damped motion where we go to smaller values of phi and eventually approach phi equals zero and have some ADS boundary. On the other hand, in the cosmology picture, which is on the left-hand side here, we again impose this, initial condition, which is time symmetric at the same point phi naught that we have in the wormhole. And then we could think about evolving forward or backward in time. If we were to evolve backward in time, it's maybe easiest to think about what happens moving from the Big Bang towards this time symmetric point. We have some period of perhaps accelerated expansion, the particle is moving down this potential, there's some period of deceleration, and then eventually we would hit this time symmetric point, and then the reverse would happen. The universe would start to accelerate and then would go towards this this positive potential. Great, okay, so that's the input that we have from holography. Now we can talk a little bit about cosmology. I see there's a raised hand. Does someone want to ask a question?
Yeah, I would have a question regarding the previous slide.
Sure.
So the sign difference between the two views on the potential only arises due to the difference between imaginary time axis and real time axis?
Yeah, that's right. If I understood your question correctly, you're asking about the difference between thinking about V in the cosmology picture and minus V in the wormhole picture. And yeah, this is just a direct result of doing an analytic continuation of the equations of motion. The result will be to for something like this, this equation here, the result will be to flip the sign for anything that has two time derivatives. That's the same as flipping the sign for these first two terms. But we could also think about this as corresponding to some particle moving in an inverted potential. So where we didn't flip the signs of the first two terms, but instead flip the sign of the potential.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no problem. Great, okay. So now moving on to cosmology. Okay, so now that we've got sort of the holographic input that we want to apply to these effective theories, we can start by asking if it's possible to obtain a realistic cosmological background. So maybe the first thing we'd want to try to do is to see if we can obtain a background that has at least some period of acceleration. So to start off, we can just look at what the equations of motion are in the Lorentzian cosmology picture. So we have some scalar field equation, which is the analytic continuation of the equation that I was just talking about. And then we also have some Friedmann equation. So the Hubble expansion here is sourced by some kinetic and potential terms for the scalar, as well as perhaps some matter term and some radiation term. It's straightforward to show that combining these two equations gives rise to some third acceleration equation, which describes the acceleration of the scale factor as a function of time. And just looking at the sort of signs that appear on the right-hand side of this equation, we see that the kinetic energy, the matter and the radiation all contribute negatively to the acceleration. These are all sort of manifestly negative terms. So an immediate consequence of this equation is that having a period of acceleration necessarily requires that the potential should be positive. Okay, so we could just write down some potential that satisfies the conditions that we want close to phi equals zero, but then it also eventually becomes positive at some larger values of phi. In fact, there are reasons to think that this would be sort of a relatively generic thing that might happen in ADS-CFT, where having some extremum with a negative second derivative here would correspond to the existence of some relevant operator in the corresponding holographic CFT, but then we might still expect that the potential should be bounded from below. So maybe it would reach some minimum after the sort of concave down part close to phi equals zero, and then it might start to increase. We can think of some potential that satisfies the conditions close to phi equals zero, but eventually goes positive. So are we done? Does this ensure that we have an accelerating cosmology? The answer is no. So in addition to the constraints on this potential, we also have to remember that we have a constraint that we're interested in time symmetric initial conditions. So if we impose some time symmetric initial conditions somewhere on this potential, and then say we evolve backwards in time to understand what the universe looks like before the recollapse, it could be the case that the potential might never dominate in the acceleration equation I just showed you. It could be the case that the kinetic or the matter and radiation terms are always larger. So in particular, here's an example. So what I'm plotting here on the x-axis is the scale factor. So the right-hand side of this figure is like the time symmetric point. And then I'm solving backwards in time towards the Big Bang. On the y-axis is like the energy contribution to the acceleration equation from different components, like the kinetic energy or the kinetic contribution from the scalar, the potential contribution or the matter in this cosmology. I've taken some arctan on the y-axis just to compress things and for the sake of visualization. But the point here is that we see that in this solution, the potential eventually does become positive, like the scalar field reaches a positive part of the potential during the evolution of this cosmology. But this potential term is always dominated by the kinetic and matter terms. So we would expect that this cosmology is just decelerating for all times. So a natural question to ask is whether or not there do exist any potentials so that we do obtain a period of potential domination in our time symmetric solution. And we might further ask if it's generic to find acceleration or not. So I'll briefly argue that obtaining acceleration doesn't require significant fine tuning of the parameters or of the initial conditions. For the sake of concreteness, I'll argue about this in the case of a particular family of potentials. So this is just some example. We have some family of potentials here. We have some constant term, some quadratic term, and then some exponential term. So these potentials are manifestly some even functions. And this V int, the quadratic and the constant term here are just chosen so that for the entire family of potentials that are parameterized by this parameter G, we always have a cosmological constant, which is like -1 in the units I'm working in, and all of these potentials saturate the Breton-Lohner-Friedman bound. So this is just some particular one parameter family of potentials. So this is just illustrating what I was talking about. So we have the same cosmological constant in each case, this value of the potential at phi equals zero. What I should say is we have the same value of the potential at phi equals zero, corresponding to the same ADS radius in the Euclidean picture. And all of these solutions saturate the Breton-Lohner-Friedman bound, but they have different behavior away from that. So in this family of theories, where we think about a scalar that has this potential, and we also have some radiation, say, turns out that the time symmetric solutions are completely parameterized by where we choose the time symmetric point to be, what value of phi we choose as the time symmetric point. At least that's the case up to some rescaling of the cosmologies that we're thinking about. So the space of time symmetric solutions is totally is parameterized by this phi naught, and then the space of these different theories is parameterized by this parameter G. And then in particular, we can just ask, you know, for various values of phi naught on the x-axis here and various values of g, if the corresponding cosmological solutions have some period of acceleration. And so this is some plot. The part in red shows where we do obtain some period of acceleration, and everywhere else there's no period of acceleration. So this plot hopefully illustrates that at least it's the case that obtaining acceleration is like, or the parameter, the part of the parameter space where you obtain acceleration is like codimension zero in the full parameter space that we're considering here. So, you know, at least in this example, it seems like there's no sort of fine tuning that's necessary to achieve some period of acceleration, which, you know, you might be worried that say the part of the parameter space where you got acceleration was like codimension one or something even worse, which would be the sort of red flag for some fine tuning. You might be worried that I chose to saturate the Breton-Lohner-Friedman band here. And it turns out if you choose not to, if you have some mass that's between the Breton-Lohner-Friedman bound and zero, qualitatively you end up with something similar. Again, you have some region in the parameter space where you obtain acceleration, which again is like codimension zero in the full parameter space. But in general, if you increase this mass, the size of this region decreases. But you would need to take M to be like, you know, parametrically small in order to obtain some region that was very small. All right. Now that we've talked a little bit about, you know, whether or not you can obtain acceleration in these field theories with input from ADS-CFT, we can try to be a little more ambitious and ask if it's possible to obtain something more realistic for the cosmological backgrounds. So yeah, this is the question we'd like to ask now. Is it possible to get more realistic cosmological solutions? It turns out this is also fine, although it's important to stress that at least from the perspective of the effective theory, there's certainly a trade-off between obtaining some particular scale factor evolution that one would like to obtain and the requirement of some fine-tuning of features of the potential. At least as far as we can tell, it seems to be the case that you can pretty much get your cosmology to have a scale factor that's arbitrarily close to the scale factor that you might like, but that it might require you to tune some parameters in the potential in order to do this. An important thing to mention is that in reality, the observational constraints that we have on the scale factor coming from observations like type 1a supernovae, it turns out that, you know, those constraints are such that they are consistent with quite a broad range of different potentials. So if we knew the scale factor exactly, then that would pose the requirement of pretty severe fine tuning on the potential. But in reality, if we want to fit the data rather than necessarily fitting some particular functional form of the scale factor, that allows for a lot more possibilities in the potential and possibly could help to sort of get around this issue of fine tuning. So we'll talk about that a little more in some upcoming work, but I'll also give sort of a first example of this fact in the next few minutes. So just as an example to illustrate what I'm talking about, we could think about trying to reproduce a scale factor that would arise from the Lambda CDM model in the context of these models that satisfy the sort of holographic constraints that I've talked about. So here's some potential. It does satisfy that, you know, V of zero is zero and the other conditions that we want to put on the potential near phi equals zero. However, we want that in order to agree with Lambda CDM, at least a portion of the potential should be, you know, very close to being flat in order to be something like a cosmological constant. And we also want that the kinetic energy of the scalar during the evolution that is supposed to be relatively close to Lambda CDM, that kinetic energy should be very small so that, you know, the motion of the phi in a potential approaches something like just a cosmological constant. So in this potential, what we would like to do is think about starting the, or, you know, choosing some time symmetric initial condition at some initial point. And then say we could evolve backwards in time. This phi would evolve towards larger values of phi. So it will go down into this trough and then eventually into this positive region of the potential. But some tuning of this feature in the potential and, or possibly of the initial condition is required to ensure that the kinetic energy by the time we get to this plateau is quite small. And then some tuning of the potential to be quite flat is necessary to ensure that the kinetic energy would increase sufficiently slowly as we sort of move along this plateau. So the result would be that basically if we looked at the corresponding cosmology, which we'll do on the next slide here, at relatively early times where we have the scalar sort of evolving along this plateau towards smaller values of phi, we have the yellow curve, which is lambda CDM, and the blue curve, which is our model with the potential I was just showing. Those would agree very well. And you know this agreement can be made, you know, to very good approximation for very long times into the past. On the other hand, eventually we would see some divergence between these two theories. The lambda CDM model would become cosmological constant dominated, and so would continue to accelerate. Whereas our model, eventually the scalar would you know, fall into this well in the potential, and then raise up to some time symmetric point. The universe would undergo some recollapse, some time symmetric recollapse, and then the scalar would start to, you know, sort of evolve back through the potential. The purpose, though, is to illustrate that basically, if we're interested in reproducing the lambda CDM model within the context of this class of effective field theories, you know, for an arbitrarily long period of the cosmological history, there seems to be no problem of doing that. So as I've tried to emphasize, we tune the potential here to be flat in order to match lambda CDM, but in reality, we would like to match observations rather than lambda CDM, and that allows us a lot more freedom in choosing this potential. So in particular, I'll briefly in the last few minutes talk about some example where it's actually possible to have that the change in the potential is relatively large in the region that's probed by our cosmological observations. But despite that, we're able to consider a model where we have significant variation of the potential over a region which is probed by observations, but is still in perfect agreement with observations. So in particular, these type 1a supernovae that I've referred to before probe the scale factor in a particular range. So where in the range where the scale factor was roughly a third of its current value all the way up to the present. And it's possible to think about models where the scalar potential varies substantially throughout this range of cosmic evolution. So as a model that realizes this, we can think about something called the WCDM model. So in this model, the dark energy is modeled as a perfect fluid, which has some equation of state relating the pressure of this fluid to its energy density with some constant parameter W. So the cosmological constant is some special case where this W parameter is equal to -1. And the WCDM model, much like the lambda CDM, can be realized by some scalar field just by choosing the kinetic energy to be zero and the potential energy to be some value of a cosmological constant. Similarly, the equation of state with some constant W can also be realized in the context of some scalar field model, just ensuring that the sort of evolution is such that this equation here relating the kinetic and potential energy to the constant W holds. So the observations of type 1a supernovae give us some constraints on the possible values. If we assume a WCDM model, these observations give us some constraints on the value of W. So in particular, they constrain them to be in this range of -0.9 plus or minus some 0.1. And so, again, we can ask whether or not it's possible to you know, obtain the evolution of the scale factor that would correspond to this WCDM model within the context of our model. So here, the red portion of these plots is what we get from the WCDM model with the value of the parameter W and the other parameters given by this fit to the supernova data. So this red curve is basically the WCDM model as realized by some evolving scalar field within the range of redshifts that is probed by the supernova observations. But again, we can sort of like consider some black potential here, which satisfies our constraints coming from holography, but also agrees very well with the potential that would have to give rise to the WCDM model. And indeed, if we think about the model with this black potential, and then we look at the corresponding time symmetric cosmological solution, and we think about the evolution of this the parameter W that would arise from this evolution in this time symmetric cosmology, we see that the evolution of this parameter as a function of time is you know, very well within the constraints that come from these type 1a supernova observations. But the point is, you know, as you can see from this plot on the right, in this situation, we actually have that the variation of the potential in the range which is probed by these type 1a supernova is quite significant. So the variation in the potential is you know, roughly the same scale as the value of the potential in this range. So this is intended to illustrate that while one might be worried about having to sort of like unnaturally tune the potential within this region to be very flat, that's only the case if you specifically want to recreate the scale factor for the lambda CDM model, but there's a much broader range of possibilities for the potential that would be able to agree arbitrarily well with the supernova data we have. Great. So in the last 5 minutes here, I'll just end with kind of some conclusions and outlook. So just to summarize, I hope I've kind of illustrated that cosmology with a negative cosmological constant and some time-dependent dark energy appears to be at least observationally consistent and seemingly theoretically well-motivated. We tried to formulate some conditions on lambda less than zero effective field theories that might admit a conventional holographic description. So in particular, this puts some constraints on the kinds of potentials that we're interested in. And it suggests that we should maybe look for time symmetric cosmological solutions that would have a good Euclidean continuation to an asymptotically ADS wormhole. We saw that at least, you know, in some simple examples, it appears to be the case that obtaining some period of acceleration is a relatively generic generic state of affairs. At least we illustrated this for some particular families of possible effective field theories. We also argued that it seemingly is possible to obtain a more realistic cosmological background, which you know, we can make to agree with whatever model we might like for sort of an arbitrarily long time into the cosmological past. But the price to pay for this is some tuning. Although, as I sort of eventually argued, it may be that if we would just like to match with astrophysical observations, rather than necessarily exactly reproducing the functional form of the scale factor from some model, that this could perhaps, you know, eliminate at least some of the tuning that's going on here. Something that I didn't end up talking about today, but that also appears in this paper is that we discuss the possibility for these effective field theories to be supersymmetric, since again, this is sort of an interesting possibility in the holographic context. And so what we found in the paper was that indeed, there's sort of some simple n equals one supergravity theories that one can write down, where we're able to reproduce the kinds of potentials that I've been talking about here to arbitrarily good accuracy within the sort of the region of scalar field space that would be relevant for both the wormhole solution and the cosmology solution. So given that, we can ask sort of what some next steps might be. So something that I mentioned was this question about directly reconstructing the scalar field potential from supernova observations. So this is something that we're looking into, but an interesting possibility is to sort of understand the sort of like general space of possibilities that would be consistent with sort of direct observations of probes like type 1a supernovae would be, and trying to understand this question of fine-tuning within this class of models. Another big interesting direction to look into within the context of these cosmology models is to see if we can start to work towards an explanation or understanding of how structure appears in these models. So definitely the sort of modern cosmology is really based on trying to have a detailed explanation of the origin of structure and the evolution of structure. So certainly it's a very good check to make sure that we're able to realize sort of a realistic cosmological background within the theories that I've talked about here, but ultimately we would like to have sort of a more detailed structure or a more detailed understanding of inhomogeneities and like anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background and these kinds of more detailed quantitative questions. And then lastly, of course, here I've just talked about some work at the level of the effective field theory, but it would be really great to have a more detailed understanding of sort of the microscopic theories that might be relevant for sort of providing a UV completion of the effective theories that I've been talking about here. So as I think I mentioned, Mark suggested or had some work suggesting some candidate microscopic description involving some particular supersymmetric CFT constructions. So I think understanding the physics of these theories better, either in sort of the CFT picture or the corresponding 10-dimensional supergravity solutions or having an understanding of the corresponding effective field theory, having a better understanding of the physics of these particular models, I think would be an important step towards sort of moving from the effective field theory analysis to sort of a more genuine, sure-footed understanding of possible holographic description for these cosmologies. Great. Okay. I guess with that, I will wrap it up and say thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for a great talk. Any questions? Hi, Alex. Yeah, you can unmute yourself.
Hey. Thanks for the great talk. I had a couple questions, I guess. I guess one like big picture thing is I feel like this whole direction of understanding cosmology or you're constructing cosmological models within ADS CFT, you could maybe take two perspectives on. So you could say, maybe this is actually the way our universe is, and this is sort of a honest full model of the cosmology we find ourselves in. That would be the ambitious thing, and I feel like you've made a decent case for that, and that's very exciting. But you could also like take a somewhat less ambitious perspective and be like, well, here's some well-defined UV complete microscopic theories where we can study things that at least share many features with cosmology in our universe. So it'd be sort of an analogous to perspective to like, we think about black holes and ADS and we try and understand the information problem and all these things. And, we're sort of interested in that basic physics and we're not caring that much that, it's actually an ADS and maybe we don't live in ADS or whatever. So anyways, this is a very long-winded way of saying like, I guess there's basic puzzles in cosmology like flatness or the horizon puzzle, or you would know these things better than me. Do you think like, does this perspective like address some of those puzzles? And then maybe there's some hope that the resolutions within this ADS CFT context will will make sense outside, even if this isn't a full description of cosmology, or I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely, I think taking either perspective on this is fine. I think, as you say, the fact that this framework seemingly resolves some kinds of naturalness issues that arise in traditional cosmology, like these homogeneity and flatness and all these kinds of cosmological puzzles, that those are sort of, you know, built into the framework that we're describing here. Yeah, that's plausibly a reason for taking them seriously, although of course, you know, people have other ways of you know, in standard cosmology plus inflation is also a way of resolving these problems. So
do you want to say a bit like how this picture resolves those problems, or has them sort of baked in?
Yeah, I mean, so the flatness puzzle is just sort of it's just built into the symmetry of the solutions we're considering.
I see. Yeah.
Like the holographic description here would involve some CFTs that live on R3, say.
Yeah.
Some three-dimensional CFT. So some CFTs that are like have got planar symmetry. Or some 3D CFT construction that has like a three-dimensional planar symmetry. And so, you know, in, say I'm talking about the Euclidean picture, that this, we would expect that like the vacuum, or yeah. Let's say we're talking about this 3D, 4D, 3D construction, and I'll talk about sort of the Lorentzian ADS wormhole that corresponds to doing some analytic continuation of the Euclidean wormhole, which is different from the analytic continuation that I was talking about here. Then we would expect that the vacuum solution for this theory is just this planar Lorentzian ADS wormhole, and the symmetries in the CFT are sort of like they're manifest in this solution. And doing these analytic continuations, the results in also having this planar symmetry in the cosmology picture.
I see.
But go ahead.
If you didn't have this flatness property, then we just wouldn't know how to embed these things inside of ADS CFT. So we have this. This flatness property of the cosmology, and that's like baked into the way that you've embedded these cosmologies within the framework of ADS CFT. And so, right, and so that makes this flatness seem like a consequence of the sort of CFT description, and then. Yeah, I guess I'm just repeating this back to myself, but then the point would be, you know, if cosmology somehow didn't have that property, then we wouldn't have known how to put it into ADS CFT. And yeah, so this is, you could see it as sort of flatness as a prediction of assuming that these things are embedded in ADS CFT in some way, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that you could also think about some holographic theories that perhaps would, you could think about some holographic theories maybe on some different backgrounds that were not conformally flat, something weird like that. Maybe that would give you solutions that would not have the symmetry, but certainly I don't know. Often when we're thinking about these simple holographic constructions, it's natural to assume some relatively symmetric background for the CFT.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
But, yeah, to the spirit of your question, I think, was maybe like how seriously to take these models.
Right.
Like, do we necessarily think that, you know, our universe is described by some 3D, 4D, 3D CFD, or are we just wanting to use this to try to understand cosmological physics in the same way we've understood black holes and ADS CFD? And I think you can take either perspective, although the purpose of my talk is to at least, you know, try to argue in favor of the first perspective.
Yeah.
Another possibility is that, like, you know, the specific microscopic holographic theories that I've sort of tangentially mentioned, that could plausibly give rise to the kinds of wormhole solutions that we're thinking about here. It's plausible that actually the correct underlying holographic theory should be something slightly different, but that the conclusions that, or like the basic holographic input that I've tried to argue for, which is that we would like to have these asymptotically ADS wormholes so that we have a relatively standard holographic dictionary, and then we can analytically continue to a cosmology, that might be sort of, I think it's kind of compelling to suspect that maybe that might be something like a general approach to describing cosmology in a holographic context. Mm-hmm. But maybe the actual theory should be, you know, maybe we should think about some ensemble of holographic theories or something like that. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. If not, let's thank the speaker again.
Thanks.
And do you just want to stick around for a minute, Chris? We'll maybe kick other people out. Chris, is co-host, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, thanks for the talk. It's nice. Actually, I had just another question, just a technical question about the talk before we talk about other things. But which is just, so you had these constraints on the potential that come from needing this analytically, like the Euclidean picture, to be asymptotically ADS. And then you're showing that, you know, you can construct potentials that satisfy all these properties that, you know, have some phenomenal, experimentally nice features. You can, you know, have those properties and match various data sets. Is it clear, have you looked, or like, is it clear that, like, if you violate some of those holographic properties, that the cosmology kind of goes haywire? Like if I break the BF bound, do I know that I'm now going to not get acceleration in the way I need, or?
So no, I don't think so. So, I think typically, like what we seem to find was that, first of all, if anything, the holographic constraints would be problematic for the cosmology, like it.
Okay.
How should I say? Like.
Maybe it's like the surprise is that you can have both work out. Not that imposing the holographic constraints is going to then imply that you have, or you know, strongly suggest that you have exactly what we see, like this accelerating.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like, sort of for the reasons that I was talking about. If you think about some general potential that satisfies the holographic constraints, but maybe then has some minimum and then increases to some positive value, which you would need to get some period of acceleration. You know, a generic situation, it is often the case that there just is no period of acceleration at all in those examples.
Yeah, I see.
So the plots I was showing you, like the white space was solutions where there's no acceleration at any point during the cosmology. The red space were examples where there is at least some small period of acceleration at some point in the cosmology. So then in order to get something that's more realistic, like you really have to be careful about what the features of the potential look like at larger values of phi. But yeah, I guess the point is that like, so that would seem to be a challenge, but what we eventually found was that essentially there's enough freedom in the potential that like, despite the fact that getting that sort of cosmological behavior that you might want is not like generic. So getting acceleration maybe is generic in some sense. Getting exactly the cosmological behavior you want is not generic, but it seems like possible for any given scale factor evolution that you would like, as long as you are allowed to sort of do some tuning.
Then the one last thing was, so at the beginning of the talk, you talked about the Hubble tension. And then I guess like that basic fact that it seems like the Hubble parameter in the early universe and what we get sort of like a more local, like a local in time measurement in terms of this supernova data, you seem to disagree, like feels like heuristically suggestive that there's some scalar potential and we should think of the dark energy as varying in time. So, which, yeah, then of course you have in your model. So is there some hope of like, or maybe you addressed this already in the talk, is there some hope of like reproducing sort of both the early universe and current universe data from the kind of model you're talking about?
I think that's like a very interesting question to look into. I think we're very interested in looking into that. As I mentioned, there are various observational constraints that need to be satisfied, and they seemingly limit the possible time dependence of dark energy. Like the sort of one of the most successful models proposed to ameliorate this Hubble tension situation is this early dark energy model. And so in this model, they need some particular period, like some particular bump of early dark energy that occurs like, in a particular window before recombination and then sort of decays away. And that scenario sort of allows one to get rid of this Hubble tension, but without messing up some other measurements of the sound horizon that
I see
can occur at a slightly different time that we're also able to probe by looking at like baryonic acoustic oscillations or
okay.
So yeah, not like you can't, there's a lot of literature about a huge number of proposals to resolve this Hubble tension. They roughly get grouped into like late time resolutions where you have something like a time varying dark energy between recombination and the present, or like early time resolutions where you have something happened before recombination that maybe changes the sound horizon at the time of recombination or something. And the simplest possible models for time varying dark energy that would change the late time behavior, like those are, I think, not favored, or they would make this Hubble tension worse. It's possible, and I think some people have considered somewhat more complicated models of time varying dark energy that do change the evolution at late times and are supposed to resolve the Hubble tension, but I haven't understood those in much detail.
Okay. So that, I guess it would be like, it sounds like it's quite, getting both these observations is quite constraining, and it'd be interesting to see if you can realize them within this set of potentials that are allowed holographically.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question.
Yeah.